So our panel, when it does assemble, will be chaired by, or the guy running the show will be Kyle Childress, right? I know so. And it will be our three plenary presenters as well as Sarah Noble. And so that's why we've got five chairs up here. And so it'd be Norman, Chad, and Philip, and Sarah. And if you have been at every session, you'll know who all four of those people are. but if not, Norman from Duke was our opening presenter. Chad from Barbados Project was our second presenter. Philip is our third from various places. But Chicago for sure. And Sarah from Abundant Table, right? Want to try?
As we work to figure this out, I suggest that we just switch our schedule around. We'll hear from Bill McKibben later. So, yes, it may be a post-conference address.
Let's travel up.
So everyone on the panel.
That's not an excuse to sort of ignore what people are saying about what might be happening. I read a lot of environmental scientists. I read a lot of environmental historians. So I know that from any rational point of view, the future looks really bad. So then the question is, for me, how do I think about moving forward in the context of really dire future predictions, but also the knowledge of human ignorance, and that we can't really anticipate all the things that might come our way. We don't know how to anticipate the kinds of responses people will make in the future. So I'm hesitant to talk very much about what I foresee coming down the road. Instead, I think hope is an action that comes out of a fundamental disposition that I think as Christians we are called to have. And I think that's a disposition that's framed primarily in terms of our love. I have to have hope, not because I hope that things will be good. I have to have hope because I'm called to love. And I'm called to love because I have children. I'm called to love because I'm in a community. I'm called to love because I'm in a world that's a garden. And I'm called to love because I'm in a place of wounds. And so in the context of love, what you have to do is you have to offer yourself, not knowing what's going to happen as a result of that self-offering. And there are lots of ways that that self-offering can take shape, I think. I mean, there are the various forms of activism that you can become involved in. There are the various forms of rather small, insignificant tasks, like growing a garden. There are the acts of committing to love children and young people. There are the acts of committing to address injustices around you. All of those being expressions of your love. And you don't know what's going to happen as a result of doing any of those things. But that's all right. In my view, I don't have to know what's going to be the result of what I do. Because in the end, what I have to have is my trust. Is that love is the right thing to do. Because it's love that brings the world into being. It's love that daily nurtures the world in its being. And it's love that in the end will bring about its consummation. And so, rather than focusing on what may or may not happen in the future, I think what's most important for me is to commit to these actions that grow out of the disposition of love. And that's not an easy thing to do. Because when you become aware of what people are saying about what may be in store for great many number of people and creatures in the world, my temptation is to get into the fetal position and just find a little corner of the world and just rock back and forth. But that's not anything that Christians can do, I think. And so what I say is simply try to commit to this position.
So one of the things I was thinking about is looking at hope on an institutional level. And I talked a little bit before about the Diocesan Specialists. They actually, their project is called Seeds of Hope, and it's this idea of looking at our entire diocese as a food system, and how are we linking our gardens, our food banks, starting farms, creating distribution, using the hands that are part of our already existing communities. And so there's this institutional response, and there's these creative actions that we can really leverage our institutions to do. And then there's the local, your local community, your neighborhood. And for us, that includes our church body. And for the Abundant Table, we feel really strongly that hope comes through our liturgy. And some of that is the need to lament. And I know Reagan and I were at a conference last fall, and he was bringing up the importance of lament and reconciliation as part of our process of moving towards hope and celebration. And one of the things that we do is, on Good Friday, I talk about how we've done an immigration Station of the Cross, but one of the things that we're really trying to build into that is doing a Station of the Cross that laments the burdens that the earth and our farm workers carry, and how does that lead us to Station 14, which is, or 15, is the resurrection, and what does the resurrection look like in our context, and how are we actively bringing that resurrection about creatively. And I think that's beginning to know the ecosystem that we live in the same way that plants are part of ecosystems, animals, and we are connected to that ecosystem as well. Organizationally, we are part of an ecosystem. And I love the biblical story, you know, look at the birds of the air, the flower, you know, God takes care of even the flower because it has to clothe itself. Well, it's because that flower is part of an ecosystem. It's not like just one individual flower exists on its own. God created an ecosystem for it to flourish. And in the same way, each of us has an ecosystem that we really need to identify and know what is good in our ecosystem that will cause us to flourish. And finally, on a personal level, what are we doing to be prepared to be a people of hope, to be a community of hope? And I think some of that is finding the role that you personally play in this work. And everyone plays a different role, and we really need to know what is that role that we each play. Whether it's being the pastor and the priest and the farmer, or just the farmer, or the climate change activist, or are you the bridge builder that is, you know, kind of sitting in the middle, or are you the person like banging down the wall? And I think everyone has a different role, and we need to honor each other's role, but you need to know what your role is. And then also to ground and root yourself in your location and in your community, listen to the animals, the plants, and listening to the greater cosmos. And the hope, I think, as a farmer, we do plants, and we see the death that comes from when we till under our whatever does not need to be harvested anymore. You know, new life grows out of that, and there's always hope in the field. There's always hope in our natural world, and how do we understand hope through what the natural world is telling us?
I tend to be by temperament kind of Augustinian in my pessimism about human nature and the pervasiveness of sin, and aspire to the greater confidence in God's grace that inspired Augustine to be a great bishop and saint. I hope that animates me more, I guess, in my temperamental inclinations. But I see hope in a number of places. I think just most personally, coming out of what I do, I have a great deal of hope for the work that that our students will do coming out of University of Notre Dame School of Architecture, from where I taught prior to going there to the University School of Architecture. I can see some of that starting to occur in the world, and I to have reason for hope that that influence will grow. I think those of us who are in education are absolutely involved, at least metaphorically, in planting seeds. And so I have to take a great deal of pleasure in the people that I work with, the students that I work with, and I actually have a great deal of confidence in them and the work that they will do. I actually have a great deal of hope just from this gathering. The kinds of things that we think about it every day, the kinds of projects that I'm involved in, some of them tend to be big picture, long range kinds of projects. But I know from life experience that anything good that happens happens locally, happens on the ground, and I can see just the evidence of things that are happening that I was unaware of, only vaguely aware of, coming to this meeting. So it's been particularly gratifying to me to reacquaint myself a little bit with the legal place. I know Greg Clark for about 15 years, but it's been good to see the representation of the place here. Of now I'm blanking on our friend in Indianapolis at the Inglewood Church. Yes, thank you. I gotta say, that was a great moment. It's a great moment that can be presented in this context and everyone reacts the way that it happened as we hope to. Loving you. connection to your neighbors, and your neighbors can, when you walk to them, or are in an environment where you see your neighbors on a daily basis, and somehow manage to systematically order and learn in ways to prevent that. So anything that churches can do to engage in what reformers do believe that we call the ecclesiastical stall repair, those are good projects to undertake. And I know a lot of people who could help you do it in a very satisfying way. So anyone who might do that is probably good.
Well, I want to thank the Ecclesia Project for the opportunity to be with you. I speak for Sarah, those of us from California. Always appreciate when we can represent back here and to have the kind of space to tell our story in this room where there are so many stories to be told. Really appreciate it. It's my understanding that the Ecclesia Project, one of the characteristics of your central ethos is developing practices and disciplines of what it means to be church. And I think that is the heart of the conversation around these kinds of issues. For the last 15 years in our little shop, we've worked with a household covenant idea around Sabbath economics, in which we identify seven areas in which our lives concretely intersect with the economy, and to develop seven disciplines, seven being a statutory number, around how we handle money, both surplus and debt, and how we deal with the blood footprint, how we express our solidarity with marginalized, how we consume, how we work. And having that sort of very simple tool for analysis and discernment of practices is the kind of thing that can cut through the paralysis and cut through the abstraction that tends to prevail when we think of things like economics. I think the same is true if we think about the environmental crisis that we're in. We will come to clarity insofar as our analysis meets our hands and feet. And so I would like to make four or five suggestions, things we're experimenting with in our lives, to try to stay awake and sober to this moment. We are in the midst of kind of a triple crisis, the ecological crisis, the crisis of deepening disparity between rich and poor at home and abroad, and the crisis of the collapse of imagination. I think imagination is a big deal, and I would strongly encourage you, when you go home, to put up on your refrigerator or up on your wall or above your study desk or even on your home altar a map of your watershed. And so you can look at it every day. I don't think there's anybody in this room who could not close their eyes and visually imagine the political boundaries of the state that it's been burned on our consciousness. And one of the ways to reboot imagination is to allow a new image to start percolating. And you will be surprised at how that starts working on you, just the shape of that watershed. How it will make you curious to know more, how it will give you a different sense of identity. The same way in which I invited you to introduce yourselves to each other based on your watershed location, even if you are not yet able to do that. Doing that is a simple habit. It's a real simple thing. But it's a way of living into it, in the same way that when we came to faith, we began to introduce ourselves as disciples of Jesus. That was new for many of us. But when you name it, then you kind of have to claim it. So exercises of imagination like that. Simple, repetitious is a way to retrain our imagination. And I do believe that theology and practices of replacement need to be in fundamental conversation with a different sense of space. Which leads me to the second suggestion, and that is covenant with yourself, your household, your community. To embrace a new discipline of literacy in your place. Another way to put that is apprentice yourself. Make a decision to apprentice yourself to some aspect of your place. That may be around growing a tomato. That might be around helping remove invasives from the local creek and plant natives. That may be trying to figure out how to find locally sourced wine for Eucharist. But make a covenant to apprentice yourself in some way. To learn, to build your literacy in your place. And see that as part of your discipleship. As fundamental as any other aspect. And that's to figure out a new vector of apprenticeship is different than congratulating yourself for what you already do. In our Sabbath theological work, we always talk about we are where we are. But the point of figuring out where we are is to figure out what the next step is, not to congratulate ourselves for what we already do, but to say now what is the next step. The third thing, and this is important, I think, for folk in this room, let us never underestimate the spiritually deadening power of comfort and privilege. We have jobs, we have homes, we have tenure. It's a whole lot easier for us to be philosophical about the crisis we're in. And so part of the urgency is to apprentice ourselves also to a part of the groan of the watershed, be that the groan of farm workers, or homeless folk, or addicts, or the groan of degraded habitat, coal ash polluted rivers. You know, the groan used in the famous passage in Roman 8 in Greek is the same word used in the Septuagint of Exodus 3. The groan of the poor that God hears. So, it is really important that we have a discipline where our lives are concretely intersecting. Whether it's praying on street corners or talking about the shop, and just hearing the groan, or whether it's keeping vigil over a part of the local forest that is in danger. It's too easy for us to operate out of our fundamental sense of security and comfort. And so we've got to find ways to step out of that comfort zone in order to encounter. I thought Kyle did a nice job in his workshop talking about his Baptist Church of Texas. It was only at the point that the church got involved in standing with the young tree seers who were resisting in Keystone XL that a lot of folk in his congregation began to get uneasy about the way things are when they started having cops doing surveillance in the parking lot and started to feel the edge of the security state pushing on the church. That was the awakening moment, and that was also the animating moment. It's when that comfort zone got punctured that was a really good example. Part of our stepping outside our comfort zone is we're going to have to figure out as disciples and as churches where and how we also exercise refusal. Refusal in terms of our own discipline, but also refusal in some public ways. I would encourage every single one of you, if you don't know where else to plug in terms of some aspect of resistance to the forces that are driving us toward this dark future, if you don't know where else to plug in, then plug into 350.org, which hopefully you'll hear about more from McKay. I know all of you know about it. It's magnificent work that they've built from scratch. You know, professor and a couple of grad students and a bunch of social media. There's people in every corner of this country, North America, who are working on these aspects. Show up. Show up at the 350.org digital. At the end of the day, I believe the integrity of the gospel, it's always true in moments of historical crisis, the integrity of the gospel literally depends on not what the church says, but what the church actually does. And I believe in our time, this is intensely true. And for the gospel to have integrity, it's not going to matter what we say. Any books we write, any talks we give, no matter how elegant or poignant, what's going to matter is how we embody this in real political space. As church. The environmental movement, by and large, is still waiting for the churches to show up. And when they do, and again, Kyle's story is so instructive, when they do, when the church does show up, there's this beautiful rapprochement that happens of, wow, you guys are alright. And actually, you have a lot of strength to the table. But where the hell are you with? Kind of thing. And so I'll just close that notion by saying that, again, in Romans 8, there's that interesting tension between creation growing and being in travail, waiting on the revealing of the children of God. The word, as you know, is apocalypse, apocalypse. It is, in some very real sense, the ancient apostle had this understanding that creation's bondage is somehow mysteriously tied to whether or not we unmask ourselves as true stewards, true children of creation. And I believe that Paul is so compelling that creation, those who stand in creation, are waiting for us to show up as children of creation. And when we do, we might be able to help animate imagination, courage, and conviction sufficiently to actually turn our history around. But it won't be anything we say. It'll be where we stand, what we refuse, what we embrace, and how we exhibit that in our demonstration projects, in every parish, every home, every day. So I encourage us to work on our local covenants, household covenants, faith community covenants, practice very specifically. We can evaluate on a regular basis and see how we build our letters, build our sense of new identity, and reawaken into place. Deepen in our resistance, deepen in our solidarity over time. We will see things change if we commit ourselves to those things. Thanks.
Pastoral Lewis said, you know, when I go home, you know, we've been working on this stuff for years. I've got everything from folks who are, you know, getting arrested to folks who are struggling about whether they need to switch to styrofoam at home or not, and they're all in the same congregation. So I encourage you, when you go to your place, you take, grab whatever handle you can around and eat together or something. Well, they love one another more and more, and share the vision and the calling more and more. I believe that I'm enough of an old Texas Baptist that I do believe that everything we do about this stuff is a witness. And we have people come up and ask us all the time, why are you active? I mean, why the styrofoam, no styrofoam, why the recycling, whatever it is. And they really, people in town, they really want to know. And I believe that you should always be prepared to put the test of your faith. So you tell them. Tell them it's about Jesus, and it's about caring for God's creation and all of that. And there are people, usually not preachers, the lay people, who get it and go back to their congregations. And so I believe in that kind of stuff. But I also believe that these practical things, wherever people are plugging in and starting or involved, is a place where they begin to experience. Now, they'll push up against the powers. But when we're doing this together, we're praying and encouraging and so on. And the last thing I want to say about this is something that I really hold on to. The verse over, a little short sentence at the end of the book of James, that says, the prayers of a faithful person availeth much, as the King James availeth much. And I think that step and action and faithful prayer, offering it to God. Small communities of faith do these things and offer them to God. That God works in them and through them in ways that we don't even understand. And so we're asked, well, how can you stand against TransCanada, a billion-dollar corporation? It's because I believe there's a whole lot more going on than a billion-dollar corporation. And that prayer of a faithful congregation availeth much. The story's not over. So that gives me hope, encouragement, and perseverance to outlast those battles. Now, Brandon, what would you like for us to do? Are we going to, what's that? We can talk more.
Another verse.
So there are, I'm sure, lots of questions and thoughts that have been percolating either from this conversation or with you throughout this time together. So we want to open it up for your questions for specific people or for whoever wants to take it on the panel. So if you would just raise your hand, we'll and wait for the mic.
It's really fabulous because there are so many reasons for suspicion between the different faith groups. And I'm thinking here, you know, interfaith as a group is Muslim, Hindu, simply in the Christian context. And when people understand how the care of places in which they live is a concern for everybody, then you have basis for conversation, which are really, really liberating. And I think it creates this context now in which people see that there's possibility to move forward without all these suspicions. And you start to work together in practical sorts of ways because you know that you're not going to be just stuck on the theoretical level. So when I'm talking with a Muslim colony and we start seeing how different communities within Islam and within Christianity are doing things,
the issue, well, how do we get together and see? So we got a Muslim garden going on at Duke campus. We say, well, how do we get Christian folks coming to a Muslim garden to help them grow their fruit and vegetables? Right? So different ways of understanding each other emerge. And this is also really important. It helps people understand that the faith positions of different traditions are not abstract. I think this is the real temptation, is that, like I said, you know, commit to acts of love. That just sounds so wonderfully abstract, but it's not. It requires knowing how do you lay on a bed, right? It requires knowing when is a watershed damage. How do we work together to repair a riparian zone, right? These things become very real. And so the translation that has to happen as a result of interfaith conversation is really important.
In our context, we deal a lot with food, and I think that's something that every faith tradition has. But we really encourage our Christian participants in our internship to really dig into their own faith tradition to understand how food is a place of like spiritual life, but also how it's this radical, there's radical transformation around how we understand food in our tradition. And about last year, we had a Muslim intern that was a part of our internship. And that completely, I think, invigorated the conversation. And she worked with me and we developed a panel, a conversation of bringing different faith leaders together to talk about why food is important in their context and what sacred texts call the participant of that faith to be... to advocate for environmental and to advocate for better food system, because when you don't have access to the food that's an essential part of your faith practice, that is, you know, that's a spiritual crisis, but it's also a justice issue. And so that was something that specifically around bringing different faith communities together, and our intern, Amina, taught me that about how this is something that crosses all communities and impacts all communities. And there's a justice issue connected when communities can no longer grow or have access to the foods that are part of their traditional services and celebrations. So for us, that's an area where we see that really important, and there's a lot of activity in multiple communities.
This coming Tuesday, the Shalom Center based in Philadelphia, Rabbi Waskow, he's calling for a fast. It's a traditional Jewish fast day. It's also Ramadan. And he's calling for people of all faiths to join in a fast on Tuesday, both for the violence that's currently happening in Israel-Palestine, but also in light of the upcoming big march in September around the climate. And joining together spiritual disciplines, traditional disciplines like fasting, across religious lines can be really, really powerful and a beautiful way of discovering both what is different and what is common between the traditions. So looking for opportunities like that is actually not, they're all close at hand in this line. So you might think about participating in the fast this coming Tuesday.
At Notre Dame, we run in Catholic University, we run into people of different faiths all the time. In the School of Architecture, elsewhere in the university. Generally, notwithstanding some problems I have with it, I've discussed with some of you, Notre Dame is a faith-friendly place. And so conversations, I find that it's actually much easier to have conversations with people from different faith traditions who acknowledge sacred order and an obligation to it out of whatever tradition they come from, that associated with that there's usually some respect for what Catholic intellectual tradition calls natural law. Which is, a tradition in which you can discuss matters of the common good starting from observation and from reason. And what I've discovered professionally in dealing it's much easier to have conversations with people from different religious traditions, I find, than to have conversations about these things with people whose outlook is essentially secularist. I find, you know, that's a bigger challenge for me in my professional life. And I think as a general thing, Christians, when we reach points of disagreement, of intractable disagreement, our obligation is to love our neighbor. But it doesn't mean that there's not kind of intellectual and evangelical argument and approach to be made. So I guess what that has meant for me in terms of thinking about the future and the stance that observant religious people take in the world with respect to public policy, with respect to ecumenical relations, it seems to me that there's vis-a-vis secular culture, that the optimistic viewpoint is what I describe to my students as a Tocquevillian view, and contrasted with the Benedictine view, in which both Tocqueville and Benedict are in agreement that human flourishing entails the cultivation of certain character virtues, and Tocqueville is describing this in the context of a pluralistic democratic society and the associations that form that help the citizens cultivate the virtues that are necessary to sustain a just democratic society. And of course, so that's the kind of optimistic view that we can do that, that we can be members of communities that participate in those kinds of conversations and contribute to the common good in that way. And my own view is that that notion of a pluralistic society of free associations and religious freedom and non-establishment, that is a good thing. That may not be an option for us. I'm not predicting, but these days that model is certainly in dispute in the public realm. And so the alternative vision, the Benedictine vision, of course, is one that came out of the idea that in some way it's necessary to withdraw from larger civil society, not because civil society is a bad thing, but because civil society has become uncivil. And where the evangelization, and this is the thing, it wasn't just withdrawal. The Benedictine tradition was an ethical evangelization, but it was evangelization. It was a slow evangelization. It was evangelization by embodying Christian culture, Christian virtue. It's interesting that the Benedictines, they withdrew, but they had an obligation to hospitality, right? So they lived within inside walls, but there are always gates, and the outside world was welcome. And so those I see as two models ahead of us, which I used to phrase it in terms of Benedict or Tocqueville, and I think I've come to that point, at least provisionally, that it's a matter of Benedict and Tocqueville, that I think some of us have vocations to participate and engage the larger secular culture, and some have an obligation to live more disciplined lives, like Anabaptist communities or Benedictine communities, and that the task of each of us is to find out where we belong in those things and to be faithful to our vocation.
My context is at this point. We had a conference we partnered with the State University and wrote from us last year on a conference on the trauma and sexual abuse. It's an interfaith conference, and on the panel we had a Catholic priest, a rabbi, a lay leader in the nearest mosque, which is about 6 miles away, and a Hindu leader and Buddhist. And the lead had a walk to the bar. predominant criticism was, how come you didn't have a Christian on the panel? So I guess the priest didn't count. So my context maybe a little different on the interfaith thing. I mean, we're doing good for the Baptist and the Episcopalian to talk to one another. That's why I'm grateful to have a state university down the road that sort of says we're going to level the playing field here. And so the Muslim and Buddhist Christian and all everybody gets to have a robust statement of their faith on whatever the topic is. So we're going to be doing an interfaith conference partner with the university next February on environmental trauma and eco-justice, and so we're working on that right now. But again, sometimes, like, look, Darius Mosque is 60-something miles away, and so folks drive all the way to be in our place. But we'll make sure we have some Christians on the panel set it up. What else? Are there other questions?
That gateway into something I've been thinking about throughout this conference, which is something I've been thinking about as we hear about the oncoming and current ecological crisis and the politicization of it. Is the disunity of the church, and how can we, I just, you know, different perspectives that you each have, how can we remain steadfast, unmoving, and yet reaching out to our brothers and sisters in Christ, who we are supposed to be more unified with, who we've allowed ourselves to be totally split from over issues like climate change and you know, a host of others. So
you're all eager.
I think about this a lot, and partly because I grew up. I think that someone else said this is maybe a mark, a mutt of the Protestant church. I've been part of the Evangelical, the Baptist, the Presbyterian, now the Episcopalian. And it's a slippery slope. And I think, so there's this part of me that is so committed to wanting to build bridges with really doing the work that you are doing around reaching out to the evangelical around climate change, and I feel like there are people committed to that and wanting to create bridges. I am also a big believer in just cut it off. And I know that sounds crazy, but so I think you have to figure out what role that you play, but I think some of the healthiest times are when churches finally split. I think sometimes being able, there are communities in here that need to act radically, and you need to know that, and you need to do it. And then there are some of you who need to continue to be bridge builders, but I think we can't let the conversation, or we can't water down the conversation solely to build bridges. And I'm a big builder. I am a good bridge builder, I think more so than most people, but I feel like I'm also learning the importance of really knowing when it's time to go your separate ways. And I think there's hope in that, because I think there's a trust that we're all moving in a direction. But there needs to, we don't want to die, kind of, we don't want to, I guess, I don't know if that makes any sense. You don't want to water down the power of the message that you feel called to on a large scale. I think relationally we can be bridge builders, but sometimes institutionally change needs to happen differently.
think the practical side of this is that it's very hard for anybody to argue against a garden in health. It doesn't matter where you're coming from. It's going to be very hard for some Christian organization to say, damn you for making good food available for chips. That's just un-Christian. They're not going to do that. Right, so that's one side of it. So doing good work will bring people together. But I also agree with Sarah's point, right? I mean, it's very clear that the climate deniers, their deep, deep fear is that the American way of life is up for grabs. Right? So you go to the Heritage Foundation, which has a big meeting about how they're going to make sure we create disinformation. And the subtext throughout the whole meeting, this is a well-funded group, is we might not be able to keep the standard of life that we know. And I think it's time to call it out. I mean, I think that we've got clerical leaders saying, this is a sin, people. Not mince words about it. I think it's really important to do. So that the people who are very comfortable right now with the way it is, because they can live the kind of life they want, you have to say, are you following Rush Limbaugh? Or are you following Jesus
Christ? As a pastor, let me suggest, make an end run around pastors and go layperson to layperson. So if you're working in the garden, you know, layperson from one church, layperson from another church, build those relationships like that. Don't go through the chain of command. Slow, doesn't work. We're overwhelmed. We're equally threatened by somebody saying, well, y'all need to do this, especially with somebody from another church. So go around, layperson to layperson. Another question.
Okay, I think I got it here. First of all, the last couple of years, I've been working with Buddhist teaching, and I would encourage us to take advantage of 2,500 years of a religion that most Christians I know don't. They're not really a religion. It's that loves neighbor, loves enemy, and loves creation. There is a deep mind helpfulness in that. Those teachings. Second thing I want to add, this is not really a question, it's more just a statement of hope. I was hunting for quotes every week for our church newsletter. I ran across one this year from Stan Harawas that said, Jesus Christ is Lord and everything else is bullshit. And I haven't quite figured out how to get that into the church newsletter. It's probably been a million pages written about what he might mean by that. But I think one of the things that I heard the last 3 days is there is absolutely no doubt that the will of Jesus Christ is for us to take care of this creation. No doubt about that at all. So then that plugs me into this power source. I guess Paul would say, if God is for us, who is against us? God, if we're willing to follow Jesus, and we know that it's God's will for us to take care of this creation, God's on our side in this deal. And I find a huge amount of hope in it. And I hope that'll keep us going over the long haul.
Okay, I wanted to say I really appreciate your answers to the last question. I think it's important to remember just working in the field of activism that there were many churches, especially in the American Southeast, who opposed the civil rights movement until the end, and who used the Bible and the Christian narrative to portray hate. You know, there still are churches who do that. So there's a great quote, somebody said that the Bible's a fiddle that many tunes can be played in. And, you know, just because someone's, you know, purports to be a Christian doesn't mean that they're actually moving forward the gospel message. And sometimes, in order to be leaders, to be prophetic, you have to leave them behind. And hopefully they come around eventually. But my question actually has to do with I used to work for Peter Illian. Some of you know him with Restoring Eden. And he has this great mantra of love, serve, and protect. We've talked a lot about loving, or love, serve, and advocate. We've talked a lot about loving, just getting to know a place, spending time in God's creation, and serving, using your hands to actually create healthier ecosystems and healthier communities. But I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the advocacy, how churches and clergy and lay leaders could use their voice and their platform in the realm of civic leadership and public policy, because as many of us all know, that is a critical tool to fix this problem.
Can I speak to that? There are advantages to being a pastor in a town of 30,000 for 25 years. And we worked. So last week, 2 weeks ago, I was the speaker at the local Chamber of Commerce, launching 150 business leaders in our town, bankers, city council, and all that on neighborly economy, is what we were talking about. And we had local food and all that kind of stuff. So I had an entry point to be able to talk about some of this stuff, but it takes me years to get to that place of planting the seeds and work in the crowd and work in the audience and all that. And at the same time, they know we're also the same church that's trying to block the pipeline. So they're, you know, but I mean, they're 25 years hammering away, working around, visiting people in the hospital, doing all the stuff you do. And so, you know, I can't do that. So one of the ways is you've got to get out there. You know, you can't, a pastor can't sit in their office. Those days are over. That ended in 1950. You got to get out there, and you got to be at the barbershop, and you got to be at the coffee shop, and you got to be down and talking to people all the time. You got to be open, having conversations with folks all the time. And some of them are not real nice conversations. People want to get in your face. But that's what I do. If you want to find me, then you call me on the phone or text me, but I'm not in the office. Anybody else want to respond quickly?
Yeah, my daughter, she works at the Princeton International Church, so you know her, and she tells me over and over again that when she meets with legislators, they want to hear from faith communities because sometimes they feel that the moral side of the issue is not getting represented. It's all economics. And so for faith communities to speak up and say, this is wrong on moral, spiritual grounds, would be a real help to legislators who are thinking, I believe this is wrong too. But I can't say it because nobody's got my back. Right? And I think faith communities need to do a lot more to stand up for certain kinds of farmers, for sure, but also for all kinds of issues that we've been talking about.
What we are going to see if we have the Bill McKibben video restored, but I want the panel to hang tight because we'll take color expression if this doesn't come through.
Philosophy and the urban, not abandoned.
love to see not seeing those as two schools of thought, but as interconnected and depending on each other to move forward. I think we have camps of I'm in the Whittlebury camp, or I'm in the Urban Farms, and I don't know who was in charge of that camp.
That's what you like to be in charge of.
How can we meet each other better? How can we support one another and really thrive as a united movement?
Well, yes. All I can say is, among the traditional urbanists that I know, that is happening. I mean, that exists. I mean, traditional urbanists are urbanists because they believe that urbanism is a genuine human good, that human beings thrive in cities. But at least speaking out of that Aristotelian tradition of thinking about cities, when Aristotle writes about polis, he's writing about a community of 5 to 20,000 people, which is the size today of a small town. And so it's more of a challenge, I think, to think about what the Aristotelian tradition of virtue ethics and human flourishing, what that has to do with the major metropolis, which we're trying to think about. We typically work in small towns, even in our urban design studio, for precisely this reason, because there are opportunities for face-to-face political dealings. And so I think that among urbanists, even those of us like myself who don't really know anything about agriculture, there's a great deal of respect for the interrelationship between agriculture and urbanism. And I think I mentioned this book, William Cronin's Nature's Metropolis, which is a history of the second half of the 19th century of Chicago, in which he makes a very strong argument for that case. And it's a peculiarly modern thing, because it's Chicago and the whole western hinterlands that Chicago, their interrelationship and how they transform one another, not always in the best ways. And so I think, at least among urbanists, there's a great deal of sympathy, an understanding of the city as being an urban rural, an urban agrarian movement. I don't know if that exists among agrarians, but we'll work on it.
I want to go back to the advocacy piece. There are a couple of opportunities, I think, coming out of this gathering for advocacy. One is, I'd love to see this project advocate with DePaul University in its conferencing sector to lose the plastic and to maybe use a little bit of leverage, saying, we're a regular customer, but we just really can't abide by it. The most lasting thing about this conference will be the ecological footprint of it.
And we did that in the process of negotiating, and actually this represents the progress of the prior, but it represents very little progress.
Yeah, very little progress. So that's sort of taking the capacity that we have and trying to exercise that, and not thinking that that's not part of the agenda of who the Ecclesia Project is. Similarly, I think the Ecclesia Project can do advocacy in its own ethos, and look at a panel of four men and one woman, all European Americans, say we can do better than that. There are more voices, better representation, ethnically, racially, gender wise, and just keep pushing that advocacy within your own community. The Ecclesia Project has really important perspectives to offer. If it is perceived as a sort of highly intellectual, middle class white thing, your impact is going to be limited. Because that's not where the conversation is, generally speaking, particularly in some of the trajectories that we want to be part of. So those are two opportunities, I think, to
Hello, everybody. I wish I was there. So let's give a round of applause for our panel.